And welcome back to Callum and David's Any Request podcast. This is, of course, our Patreon requested podcast where you, the listener, can donate £5 a month to our Patreon and request us to do a podcast on absolutely anything you want.
That is entirely correct. We haven't done this for a little while.
No, we've been away for a couple of weeks as we've both been quite unbelievably busy.
Yeah, it's a good thing to be busy these days.
Yes.
In this climate and as freelancers. But also you've got to take that work when you can get it. So thanks for your patience. Having said that, this has been a really, really delightful request.
Yes. So... Because we've been so busy, we've had to do this request kind of slightly differently. We're going to have to split it. We were requested to talk about the film we're going to talk about this evening, but also comparing it to another film. Given our schedule, finding kind of 4 hours and then another 2 hours to record the podcast is quite difficult at the moment. So we're going to carry on over the other film we were asked to do kind of next time.
So this is a two-parter.
Absolutely.
And you're listening to part one.
Absolutely. And this week's podcast is about the wonderful, wonderful film, one of my favourite films, the great 1971 movie Harold and Maude.
That is entirely correct. I was just saying to you before this, mm-hmm. I'd only seen the film once before that I can actually remember.
Right.
I think maybe I tried to show it to an ex or something and I fell asleep or got drunk or something. but I haven't seen it in so many years, possibly like a decade. Mm. And I think the first time I did watch it was with you.
Yeah, I have a memory of us watching it way back at drama school. Probably about 11 years ago. And I'd seen it a lot up until that point, but I think for me that may well have been the last time I saw it. I don't think I've seen it for about a decade. So lovely to come back and revisit this. Wonderful,
classic.
Wonderful film.
Classic movie,
cult classic, kind of the definition of. Because, yeah, when it came out, it made absolutely no money and was critically panned.
Which I just can't believe. It was 1971.
No. I mean, people like Roger Ebert, one of the most celebrated film critics ever, gave it 1.5 stars.
I mean, why? What a knobhead. What was he, bad mood that day? Or this really kind of annoys me, but also I think it's part of what makes it such a, like you say, a cult film.
Yeah.
And it's part of what makes it so great. But I also find it really bizarre because I think as a piece of storytelling, certainly from a structural point of view, for a comedic point of view, from a dialogue, from a performance point of view, like it's faultless in so many ways.
I think it's a masterpiece. I think it really is. It seemed to be two points. One was that people thought it was too dark,
mm-hmm.
and two, people didn't like the story of a 20-year-old man and an 80-year-old woman falling in love.
Yeah,
basically is what it boiled down to, was people had a problem with those two things. But of course, over the years it gained traction. It actually started making money in, I believe, 1983.
Really?
So 12 years after, took 12 years for it to actually make a profit. Because a lot of young students discovered it. I mean, it's a very, you know, unashamedly left-wing film.
Yeah.
At a time when, you know, you're talking about hippies being killed and things like that, and a big, you know, anti-communist movement, which was seen as you know, the extreme version of left-wing hippies in America and things.
Yeah.
And so it's coming out at a time when it was kind of dangerous to be that left-wing in America at that time. And I think you had a lot of the counterculture in the early 70s started to find it and started to see it. And I think the other thing that it is as well, it is clearly a filmmaker's film. I mean, you talk about people that really love this film. I mean, a huge, I, I, I don't think, you know, Wes Anderson would exist without Harold and Maude.
Yeah, in terms of that dark sense of humour.
The aesthetic, I mean, you look at the cinematography of Harold and Maude and the use of colour, very similar to what Wes Anderson does.
In fact, you'd say Wes Anderson kind of makes all films as if he was making them in the 70s.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
They've got that feel about them.
Yeah.
And this is a really 70s film, even though it's just 71. It feels so 70s.
I think Cameron Crowe's obsession with kind of coming of age in a lot of his films, you can link directly back to Harold and Maude. I think people like Noah Baumbach and a lot of independent filmmakers today, I think you can see Hal Ashby's influence, the director of this film, who also, incidentally, is just a fabulous director, not just for this film, but a great film that I'd really urge anyone to watch called Being There, with Peter Sellers. I think Peter Sellers' best performance ever, about a kind of very simple-minded gardener that has lived on this estate his whole life and has no outside frame of reference other than this estate and what he sees on TV. And then the owner of the estate dies, and he ends up walking the streets for the first time and has this chance encounter with this rich couple who mishear. They ask what he's, and he says, "I'm Chance the Gardener," and they think he says he's called Chauncey Gardener, and they assume he's this really highfalutin posh. And suddenly the film goes on, and he ends up becoming the advisor to the president.
Oh wow!
It's a wonderful film. It's a really wonderful film, and he's one of those people that has very kind of, I guess what, like, naive wisdom you'd call it.
But yeah,
so they all take it to be these really deep philosophical things, and he's just kind of saying stuff that's quite simple, isn't it? But
it's like to them, from the mouths of babes, almost like kind wisdom of youth.
Yeah. But yeah, I'd really, really recommend it. Anyone that's not seen Being There, it's a beautiful film, and obviously stylistically very similar to this because it is Hal Ashby.
I have a vague memory of Coming Home as well.
Great,
which is the one of the big films that I remember.
I think he won the Oscar for it, Ashby.
But no Oscars for this. I also think we're going to talk about it as we go along, but something else worth mentioning is just the cinematography is wonderful. Now, I don't know, the DOP apparently is John Alonso. Mm-hmm. He's won quite a lot of awards and accolades, but I don't know if he's a particularly well-known DOP or...
Not hugely, but worked pretty consistently in the late 60s and 70s. But yeah, so the film itself was written originally by a guy called Colin Higgins, who wrote it as his postgraduate thesis. So he was still a film student at the time. And it got into the hands of someone who was a girlfriend of someone that worked at Paramount and kind of loved it and pushed it forward. And it was Paramount loved it, and Higgins was originally going to direct, but then he did a couple of test things, but they didn't like his directorial style. They said he didn't have enough experience, so they wanted Hal Ashby, and Ashby said, "I'll only do it if Higgins is okay with it and signs off."
Oh, nice.
There's a lot of instances of that when you read about the background of this film. It seemed like they were all really like conscientious and ethically minded, and because there's that instance, but there was also an instance of when the film was made, Paramount took Final Cut away from Hal Ashby.
Wow.
And apparently Bud Cort, who plays Harold, stormed into Paramount's office and said, "I am not going to lift a finger to promote this movie until you give Final Cut back to Hal Ashby."
Wow.
Which they did. The only thing he couldn't get was, there is meant to be an actual love scene that Robert Evans, who was head of Paramount at the time, it was his wife, the actress Ali McGraw at the time, had a problem with it, so he didn't want it in. But to be fair, it's not needed, and you do have the kind of morning after scene, obviously, that we'll come to, that I think is enough, and I like the ambiguity, because it's not really about that. It's not about it being a sexual relationship. And not because there's anything like wrong with that and the age difference. It's a deeper film than that. And it's about a deeper love than that.
And I actually think that it stops it becoming a kind of odd couple rom-com. It's which it could be if that relationship was given more screen time.
Yeah.
When actually it's a kind of mixture of a coming of age slash almost a buddy movie.
Yeah.
And that gives it such a kind of more philosophical edge rather than us being drawn to that part of it. So you've got also quite a lot of people, as you say, kind of ethically minded. Maybe that's why the film comes across so left-wing, because everyone's trying to be so nice about it. But also quite a lot of different people to play these two amazing characters.
Yeah.
Bud Cort, as you say, he played Harold. Yeah. Pretty young.
Yeah, very young. So the year before, he'd done, again, an amazing film that no one's seen called Brewster McCloud, which is a Robert Altman movie. A kind of, I guess, his take on the Icarus myth, because Bud Cort plays this, it's very surreal. He plays this young guy that lives inside like an abandoned football stadium and he's making a pair of mechanical wings because he wants to fly.
Wow.
And that's the film. Which made why no one's seen it, because it's very niche. It's Altman, so it's an amazing film, and it's very subversive and plays with the form of film itself. Even at the beginning of the film, if I remember, the MGM logo comes up, but when the lion comes up, they've cut the roar and it's the voice of James Stewart saying, "I forgot my line," as the lion. So even before the film starts, it's a film that's very much playing with form. And Bud Cort is phenomenal in that, as he is in this, but he's 20 years old. Gosh, at the time. Yeah. And apparently he, again, I guess because it was going around, because it was a thesis script, but he got hold of the script from a friend and read it and said, like, this is me. Like, it really resonated with him. Someone that lost his father quite young, someone that had a difficult relationship with his mother, and apparently when he went in for the audition, he just kind of said, "Hello, I'm Bud Cort and I'm playing this role."
Wow.
And obviously did. But yeah, Richard Dreyfuss, I think, was talked about at one
point. Couldn't believe that.
John Savage, and Elton John, who was originally going to do the music for this film, but was also considered to play Harold.
Wow.
At one point as well. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I don't know what Elton John's acting is like, but I think it would have been a very different film had he played Harold.
The only thing I can think of is the film of Tommy.
Yeah.
But then that's just kind of a performance. That's not really a... Yeah.
Yeah. Tommy. Tommy's a weird... a beautiful, flawed film. But also, I cannot imagine it without the soundtrack that it does have, which is by, obviously, the wonderful, great Cat Stevens.
Oh, yes.
Yusuf Islam, as many people got. I think now he goes by Yusuf Islam Stevens.
Yeah.
Kind of the bringing of two parts of himself together, which is such a Cat Stevens thing to do.
Yeah.
An amazing soundtrack and something quite interesting.
Incidentally, he was recently on the Russell Brand podcast, and it's a brilliant listen.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
I like this Under the Skin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like this Russell Brand. What I like. This phase of Russell Brand is also really good.
Yeah.
A lot of, good stuff to be had there.
This film is one of my, I remember my parents showing it, because one of my parents' favourite films of all time. And I remember seeing it quite young, and this being one of the first introductions to Cat Stevens, and just... Yeah, like I mean, Cat Stevens is probably my favorite recording artist of all time. I adore
over Prince.
But they're so different.
Yeah,
Prince is like my favorite performer of all time. I think Cat Stevens has my favorite voice of any singer in the world ever. Mm. It makes me more emotional than any other voice ever.
We were talking about how it's such a unique voice.
Yeah.
And also all the imperfections in lines that he leaves in. I think actually something about this whole movie, but also is very true about Cat Stevens, is there's a huge amount of integrity in the way Cat Stevens not only just writes his songs and performs his songs, but records his songs. You can hear every instrument in that studio.
Yeah.
You can hear the natural reverb on the piano strings inside the piano.
Absolutely,
the guitar, you can hear tiny little imperfections, which just give it so much integrity. And I think that's what's more moving, to be honest.
Absolutely. I mean, Trouble is, I think, one of the greatest songs of all time. And I actually shamelessly used it in a very similar way as it's used in this film for a play I directed back when I was in sixth form college doing Performing Arts BTEC. I did John Whiting's Know Why, the one act that has a very sad ending where essentially a child kills himself on stage, and I underscored it using Trouble because I remembered the end of Harold and Maude and how emotive that is.
Yeah.
It's short of any kind of musical, I think it's one of the most sort of symbiotic films of like a marriage of film and music. Like, yeah. it is so integral. It's so integral to this film.
Which I found interesting also because I went, well, loads of those songs existed without the film.
All but two, I believe.
Correct. But I was completely shocked that the two songs that were written for the film were Don't Be Shy,
yeah.
which is the opening song.
Yeah. Yeah.
And If You Want to Sing Out. Yeah. And I'm like, what? Yeah. No. Surely it's one of the slightly lesser known songs.
No.
It's hard because I grew up, my parents introduced me to Cat Stevens quite young, and you know, it was part of my like education of these are the people you listen to, and it's a lot of 60s guy people with guitars.
Yeah.
And I think actually that's why we watched this film, is because you and I were bonding over knowing who Cat Stevens was in our 20s and loving it. But I can't imagine those songs not being written and then being written for this film,
even though
they fit so perfectly. And then all the other ones existing outside of the film, you know. They are completely symbiotic now, and I think they will always be married. Incidentally, you know, the film's been adapted a few times into a novel and also into a play.
Yeah.
I thought, it'd be interesting to see a play version of this movie.
Both of those adaptations were done by Higgins himself, the screenwriter.
Oh, wow.
At the same time. It's a very odd, like, he did it, like, as the film came out, which I don't really know why he did that. But, well, maybe because the film wasn't that successful, so went, I'll see if I can make it successful another way. But the novel came out, like, the same year as the film, but just after the film. And then again, the play opened, like, a year later. So, it was all done very, very close together, which is, really unusual.
But we should probably talk about a little bit of the storyline for those of you who haven't seen watch it.
Just before, we haven't mentioned Ruth Gordon, who is absolutely have to talk about her. Her performance, obviously, pretty fresh off winning the Oscar for Rosemary's Baby for Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah.
And again, another person that there was a ream of people kind of under consideration for this part.
Yeah, I was reading that Peggy Ashcroft was in the running for quite a long time.
Yeah, because originally Higgins wrote, he envisaged her to be European, which kind of makes sense in terms of her sort of sensibilities in the 70s, early 70s America at the time. You would imagine that she could very easily be French or
she has to be an immigrant, though, because she has to have come from Europe during the Second World War.
Yes.
Because we learn, that she has a tattoo from presumably Auschwitz.
Which, again, is just, it's lovely because it's a split second.
It's a time,
It's a split second of the camera just cutting to Harold noticing Maud's arm, and it's never talked about, never mentioned, but we know, and then he knows that she has this history. Yeah. It's a really lovely thing about this film, actually, that you get very little backstory about either character. It's very in the moment, and the things that happen in the moment. There's one little story where Harold talks about something that happened at boarding school. There's a couple of little things that Maud says about things that have happened in her life, but it's generally watching what's happening now and these two people discovering each other now and enjoying the now, which is kind of what the film is all about anyway. So it's really lovely that they don't actually get, because you don't really need to know, because it's not about who they were, it's about who they are the moment they meet and who they turn into in literally the course of a week.
It's a very short time. It reminds me, this is a weird comparison, but in terms of the sense of dark comedy and it being a very short snapshot into people's lives, which I just love as a kind of, if it was a genre film, is About Schmidt. And it's a film that I just, every time I watch it, I'm reminded that it's a lot better than I think it is for all the kind of reasons you're saying. I'm not saying it's as good as Harold and Maude.
I think that's a really fair point. I mean, Alexander Payne, who directed About Schmidt, is another director who I would say is completely influenced by
interesting.
Hal Ashby as well. I would say he fits into that wheelhouse for sure. Interestingly, someone that you wouldn't necessarily think until you say it and go, do you know what? The kind of wry cynicism of this comedy, which I think is quite ahead of its time, actually is maybe less surprising than initially thought, but Judd Apatow. Huge.
Oh.
Judd Apatow and Leslie Mann actually named one of their daughters Maud after the character because it's such a huge influence on him. But when you think about the style of some of the comedy in this film and you think about Judd Apatow's kind of sense of humour, it does sort of make sense that he's, I say, that kind of cynical, slightly darker kind of anti-rom-com idea is very much there, I think, in a lot of what Apatow does. So that's,
And also the troubled young man.
Yes.
Slightly, something slightly off about the young man is always something that he's interested in.
Yeah. So yes, so speaking of troubled young men.
Yes.
We have this great opening.
I mean, it's just incredible opening.
Everything, the way it's shot, the fact that it deliberately you don't see Budcourt's face or who it is, you just it's framed so you just see feet and then a body and they're walking through what looks like this huge mansion. And as you say, Don't Be Shy opens it,
which I actually think is my favourite. Probably my favourite Cat Stevens song.
Interesting.
Actually. After hearing it again, then it's such a banging tune.
Yeah, it's great. And he's just kind of very slowly walking through this room. He lights a candle. He pauses and then gets on a chair and kicks the chair. And you open this film with someone suicide. Ostensibly hanging themselves. Yeah. And then it undercuts completely as. This film just constantly undercuts your expectations with the character of his mother coming in the room and just looking really just slightly and mildly annoyed and disappointed.
Yeah.
Which is odd because at this point you think it's real, right? Yeah. And then obviously he starts kind of moving around and making faces and you're okay, he's staged this hanging.
Yeah.
For some reason. And the mother's kind of getting just bored of it, clearly. Yeah,
clearly this happens regularly.
Yeah.
And then we kind of see this kind of... It's like a relay race in terms of the scenes cut between Harold killing himself to be found by his mother in some different inventive, gruesome way.
Yeah.
A conversation he's having with a therapist who's saying, why are you doing this kind of thing?
Yeah.
The priest who's kind of present and the mother who is just getting on with life. And she's very opulently rich.
Yes.
And is quite detached and doesn't, she doesn't engage Harold as a person, as a human being. It's just kind of an accessory of her life.
Yeah.
And she doesn't understand why he's not satisfied and getting on with being a kind of vacuous two-dimensional rich boy.
Completely detached, but also completely controlling at the same time.
Yeah, emotionally detached.
Yeah.
But just expecting him to do it as he's expected to do.
Yeah.
As men of a certain class should.
Yeah.
And when we say, we're filthy rich, this is a huge, huge mansion.
Yeah.
The father's not around.
No.
The mother just hosts endless dinner parties. That's what she does.
Yeah.
And Harold's expected to be there. And
He's
clearly suffering from quite deep depression.
Well, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But... Again, it's played with comically. There's this certain undercut. And we learned that essentially he's trying to punish his mother.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes it a bit of an allegory for the cry for help side of self-harm the taking of one's own life for the benefit of others, which is an interesting line that comes up.
Yeah, I mean, punishing, but also, I think, trying to get her to show some form of love towards him because later on in the film when he talks to Maud about why he does this, he's talking about the first time it happened was an accident. He was accidentally wrongly thought that he was dead because there was an explosion at his boarding school that he actually walked away from, but obviously they didn't know that, so they assumed they didn't find the body. He died in explosion and he saw how his mother behaved, and it's like he wells up, and it's the first time, the only time you really see, not the only time, but certainly the first time you see Harold cry and be genuinely upset. And it's very clear that that is the only moment he can recall of knowing that his mum loved him, and I think that's what that's I think that's there as well, is that he's constantly trying to get that reaction from her to remind him.
Didn't read it that way necessarily, but maybe we get to that point and see what it looks like. But yeah, that is the moment, really. That's the moment that he's trying to get back to slash away from, depending on how you look at it. But yeah, there's that moment where she reacts to the thought of his death, and it's obviously screwed him up quite a lot. Also, I think the fact that she's played wonderfully by what's the name of the actor?
Yeah,
I'll find it in a moment. Wonderful. I think she's an old. I think she was in like an MGM Grand. Lot actor.
Yeah.
I remember. But she's played wonderfully. But I think as a psychopath, like as a sociopath.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Like not murderous, but unfeeling.
Yeah.
Completely detached.
Yeah.
Probably quite mentally stunted, emotionally stunted, certainly.
Well, apparently Bud Cork gave her a really hard time during filming, like. When she'd be doing, like, talking to camera at him, he'd just be behind the camera with his middle finger up the whole time she's talking and things like that.
Right.
To try and get that out of her.
That's really interesting.
Set, but yeah.
Yeah. So she's trying to, you know, doesn't understand why her son does this and plays these pranks as she kind of sees them. And tries to just get him on the right track. So she sends him off to her brother, who's his uncle, in the army.
Yes.
And this is where I start to become aware of the film's sense, of the director's sense of humour, of Hal Ashby's sense of humour. Because you've got clearly a funny script, clearly juxtaposition, wonderful music, and some great performances. But within 5 or 10 minutes after this introduction, you have him go to see his uncle. And for the first, like, 30 seconds of the uncle talking, its soundtrack, like, sound design is the sound of the military and marching marching drums and guns going off as he's kind of giving speeches about wonderful war heroes. And it just completely undercuts the authority and the respect that America has for the army. Not just America, Britain, but I mean, you know, culturally.
There's also a couple of other really lovely things about this scene that I think does that as well. One is, he is talking to him, but pacing in an incredibly small circle around the desk. Which is just, you don't really notice it about the third time. You go, oh no, wait, this is ridiculous because it's such a small and there's no need.
Yeah.
and then, of course, the sort of biggest comedic set piece of the scene is the fact that he's got one arm. And he's got a cord that lifts the arm flap where the arm should be up, so he's able to salute still. Which is just
Clearly absolutely a pathological love of the army. And also, again, there's this, you know, portrait of Richard Nixon behind. And when you think, oh, that's not parody, it's his 1971. So again, what you were saying earlier about the context politically at the time. It is, you know, taking the piss out of the military and talking about how ridiculous this right-wing culture is.
Yeah.
And maybe people in 71, the establishment and the elite aren't into that. And, you know, saw it as a bash at Nixon, which it definitely was.
Yeah.
Especially when you think about Vietnam and everything that's going through right now at this time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, wonderful performance, very funny, very cutting. But it's in the hope that he might join the army, and Harold obviously doesn't want to do that at all. And then we follow Harold going about his kind of daily life, and we find that he, as well as kind of having this morbid sense of humour and trying to kind of play pranks on his mum, and he goes to a lot of funerals.
Yes, yeah, again, this kind of absolute sort of, fascination with mortality and.
And he drives a hearse.
To buy a car and he buys a hearse, yeah.
Which, again, just sums up who he is. And, you know, he's pale-faced and clad in black. And then he's at one of these funerals. They're not his funerals, either.
No, he just goes to random people's funerals.
Just pretend he's kind of a silent guest.
Yeah.
Because he likes being around death.
Yeah.
And he notices that somebody else is is crashing funerals.
Yes.
Maybe that's where Judd Apatow got Wedding Crashers from. But yeah, they're funeral crashes.
Yeah.
And so she's like, she comes up to him and says, do you want some licorice?
Yeah.
And he's like, shush, I'm pretending to be a guest at this funeral. Yeah. We're meant to be sad. And she's like, oh, well, that's ridiculous.
I mean, and this is essentially the meet cue.
Yeah, it and is. It is a meet cue.
You've
yeah.
got a meet cue at a stranger's funeral, which is, yeah, I just love. It's so subversive of what you expect of a romantic comedy in so many ways.
And when two people know instantly that each other's number's up, it's a complete leveler.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the first time that Harold as a person has ever met another human being at the same level.
Yeah. But what's lovely is that they're at the same level, but actually that their reasons for being there are so different, but yet work, because she's there because she loves celebrating life, and celebrating a person's whole life is what a funeral is about, and that's what she's all about. And he's there because he has an obsession with death.
Yeah.
But both of those two different reasons mean that they both end up going to strangers' funerals.
Yeah.
And it works. And it shows why they kind of need each other. I mean, I'd argue that he needs her more than she needs him, perhaps. But certainly they both get things from each other within this week.
It reminded me of you know, the scene in Fight Club where Helena Bonham Carter is going to meetings for conditions and diseases that she doesn't have.
Yes.
And Edward Norton's doing the same thing, even just because they need the emotional outlet, and they agree to carve up the week so they don't meet each other.
Because they
don't want to be at the same meeting and know that someone else is doing the same, lying the same way they are.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that could have taken a very interesting turn. If Harold and Maud had just said, okay, you take the funerals in this area of town, I'll take the funerals here. That could have gone that way.
Yeah.
And I almost felt that conversation could have happened when he's kind of saying, what are you doing? And she pulls up in a car.
Yeah.
And kind of is very kind of smart and witty, and kind of winks at him and says, do you sing and dance? And is a bit kind of provocative, shakes him up a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she drives off.
Yeah, in the vicar's car.
Steals
the vicar's car.
Which is just great.
I mean, she is essentially, in terms of talking about cinematic tropes, she's the manic pixie dream girl.
She is, yes, you're right.
But played by a 79-year-old.
Would you say that amazing. Garden State is influenced by
I would absolutely say Garden State is influenced. Yeah. I thought about Garden State during the scene where they have the picnic in on the grass.
Yeah.
And I thought Garden State is another one.
Yeah, certainly. That's a really good one. And also almost exclusively scored by The Shins. So Zach Braff's favourite band of all time. It made a lot more sense when I learned that Zach Braff was officially head of music for Scrubs.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, right, okay, I get this.
Yeah.
So you've got this meet cute, you've got her shaking him up, and he's amazed at this woman who is, you know, elderly.
Yeah.
He assumes she probably looks in her 70s.
She says to him, which actually it's quite an important conversation because we'll come back to it at the end, but just after she offers him the licorice, she says, did you know the person? No, me neither. They were 80. That's the age you should go out. She says 75 is too young, and 85 you're just marking time.
Yeah.
She says, I'm going to be 80 next Saturday.
So it's a lovely, what's the word, foreshadowing of what's going to happen. But they meet each other at another funeral.
Yes.
And she steals another car, but this time she says, get in.
Yeah.
And she's stolen a hearse. And she says, have you ever driven a hearse before?
Yeah.
And he says, yes, I do, actually, I drive a hearse. And she's like, oh, well, you should be driving me.
Yeah.
And they swap seats.
It's his hearse.
Oh, is that his hearse that she stole?
Yeah, she's stolen his car. Yeah.
Oh, and that's why he's fast. Sorry, of course. Yeah, that makes much more sense.
Yeah.
And they drive off and they end up going back to her house.
Yes.
Which is this kind of menagerie. It's like an emporium of things that she has ostensibly stolen throughout her life.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you're a thief. Like, and you can see him questioning, like, this is bad, right? To be a thief. Yeah. She's like, well, property is theft. Like, actually, I'm collecting things, but I don't own any of them.
There's at one point in the film, I prefer to be above morality.
Yeah, I mean, just such... The thing that only a certain person of a certain age can get away with saying.
Yeah,
and you're like, okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some lovely speeches that come later. But over this, she introduces him to the way in which she sees the world. Yeah. So the way she talks about smells, she has a contraption that has smells pumping out. And she makes him talk about it. And you see him start to react in a sensory way to the world.
Yes.
In a way that we've never seen Harold do up to this point. And you know that a spark is igniting, much in the same way a manic pixie dream girl would do to an insecure, depressed, self-absorbed man. But in a way that feels so non-contrived and original and innocent. And you can see, or I feel, that Maud sees through Harold and she sees his pain.
Yeah.
And she knows that what she wants to do, her objective, is to make Harold feel joy.
Yeah.
And she decides to in that moment, and then she continues to.
Yeah.
Just one way she does that is they have a picnic watching a building being destroyed.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, very God state. I didn't realize that.
And they start going around liberating trees, sort of trees that are planted like in front of banks and offices and things like that.
Institutions.
They want to return the trees to the wild.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely thing. Meanwhile, as all this is happening, the mother's had enough of Harold's fake suicides all the time. So decides that what he needs to do is get married.
Yeah.
So she puts him on a dating service.
Yeah.
A computer dating, which in this was very, very early days of that in
1971.
But there's a great scene where she's filling out the dating form
for him,
but just and halfway through forgets, and she just starts answering. I'm like, oh yes, I do have that.
Really funny.
Meanwhile,
Harold's loading a gun.
Yeah.
By the way, just that you know, all but maybe but bar one, all of these fake suicides are the most realistic deaths you've ever seen in your life.
Yeah. I mean, it's slightly. There are parts of this film that I think wander into magical realism, right?
Because that scene in particular with where he shoots himself in the head.
Yeah, because you see a blood stat, like what is like, yeah, most of the deaths, I'm not sure, and when he's floating in the pool.
Yeah.
But like, I most of them wouldn't be possible to fake in the way that he does them.
Yeah.
So there's something a little bit, non-naturalistic about that. And the other moment is when Maud is playing If You Want to Sing Out to Harold. Yeah. And then at one point just gets up from the piano and it's still playing.
Yeah.
And so there's just these odd little things in the film that are just slightly askew of normality.
Which I love.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's really strong. And that moment with the piano actually is probably... I wrote it down as one of my favourite scenes.
Yeah.
Because it's where she introduces Harold to music.
Yeah.
And... you know, if you've listened to any of our podcasts before, you know that we're pretty music obsessed. Also, now you know that we're both fans of Cat Stevens. This music is beautiful.
Yeah.
And the message is beautiful. And Harold enjoys this part of his sensory discovery for the first time. And it's like, God, I wish I could hear Cat Stevens for the first time.
Yeah.
I wish I could smell snow for the first time.
Yeah.
Isn't that incredible? It's one of those beautiful things about discovery of life, and it made me really philosophically happy and hippie and naive.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be that in that moment, and that allowed me to do that.
Absolutely.
In the same way, I think that we are, we're watching Harold, really prank and really try to shock his mother, but also we're seeing him imagining what it would be like to do it.
Yeah.
So actually, if you took away the comedy of this film...
Yeah.
It would be a young man at the age of 19, 20, rehearsing his own suicide and obsessing over that as a way out of his, imprisonment of depression, which is incredibly dark. I'm glad they go down the magical realism route and push the envelope so that it's not quite so oppressive.
No, but you do still get that. Because he does say to Maud when he breaks down and he's crying and he looks at her and ostensibly says, you know, I want to be dead.
Yeah.
So it doesn't ultimately shy away. You do get that.
Yeah, point, I don't think it shies away from it. I just think it pushes it into an area where we're able to release that tension through laughter.
Yes, yes.
Which makes it easier, because otherwise it would be an hour and a half of a very, very... It would be a very different film.
Yeah, absolutely.
As an experience. I think it actually makes us hear that message a lot clearer.
Yeah.
By offering us that humour and tension release. Yeah, so then you've got this kind of... Yeah, that wonderful piano scene in this evening, and she introduces him to a banjo.
Yeah.
And she's got all the instruments that she's clearly stolen over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they sit down and they have this conversation that you're talking about, where he reveals to her that about his relationship with his mother, and this story about how he was in a science lab, blew it up, and came to and went home. From boarding school, but the boarding school presumed he was dead. And he describes the mother hearing the news, raising her hand to her head, pulling out this big sigh, and then collapsing into the arms of one of the police officers. And I think that is, knowing that she's a psychopath, I think he's watching his mother fake grief.
Right.
So I think it's the moment he realised his mum didn't love him.
I see.
And I think that he says, that's the moment I realised I would rather be dead. So that's the way I interpreted it.
Right.
But likewise, it could also be, that's the moment I wanted to be dead because my mother's never shown as much emotion for me as she did in that moment.
That's how I read it, yeah.
I don't know. I think maybe
there's
that makes more sense.
There's an ambiguity there, isn't it? No. I think both work. Both work. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily agree with you, perhaps, that she is a psychopath. I think, because there's the reaction quite early on when he has pretended to slit his wrists, and she does get upset.
She says enough of this.
I don't know if it's as cut and dry as that, and that she doesn't love him. I think that's maybe too simplistic a way of looking at it. I think there might
But either way, that is the turning point in his life, as we say. And she says to him, why would you choose death when there's so much more, like, you've got so much more living to do. And she gives him this amazing kind of like speech, which is funny and sending herself up, but at the same time, really moving.
Yeah.
She's like, live, go out and live. Yeah. L-I-V-E. And she's
go, team, go. Yeah. Otherwise, what have you got to talk about in the locker room? Yeah.
And don't live too morally. Be above morality. Yeah. And then you'll live your life to the fullest. He at that moment, I think he kind of falls in love with her.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, laid on. It's just, I think that would be the moment that he changes from I'm hanging around with this eccentric old woman to this woman's changed my life.
Completely. So as we say, in amongst that, you start getting these dates that are set up by the mother. So the first one, he pretends to set fire to himself, self-immolate, but then comes in, so it's actually, it's a weird way of doing it, this one, because he's pretended. I mean, all of them is meant to be him pretending, but then this one he's pretended and done like a magic trick where he's got out and
which
there's a
terrifies the woman,
which terrifies the first date, and she just runs out screaming. And then you have the second date where he just sits there and just chops off his hand with a meat cleaver. And then you have the third date, which is, as you said at one point, which I always think when I watch this film, go, oh, it feels like this is the closest to someone that maybe he could have a future with, because she's this quite eccentric actress and completely believes that it's a performance when he does it.
He commits Harry Capital.
He commits Harry Carrot.
Sepuki is the other.
Yeah.
Word for it. Takes a knife and drives it into his stomach.
Yeah.
And I think it's the least convincing one because there's not enough blood.
Yeah.
But yeah. It, It's a very good performance.
It is, yeah. And she talks about how she played Juliet and starts reciting Romeo and Juliet.
She kills herself.
But she actually does it.
Yeah.
So she's at, because it's not a trick knife. So she's, that's her dying.
Well, I don't know this. No, because it is. She touches the knife.
Yeah.
And it isn't, it doesn't move.
No, yeah. So she, you know, and there's loads of blood and she's dead
and
on the floor.
She actually kills herself.
Yeah, that's the gag.
But it's like so dark. Yeah. I couldn't get my... I was like, yeah. That, which is why there's not that much blood when he does it, because yeah. You have to show that it's really happened to her.
Yeah, yeah.
But also...
Yeah, and so that maybe that is why the mother is a psychopath. She comes in, it's just, that was your last date. Is yeah, her, that's what she says. Reaction.
It's her reaction to it. But it's brilliant, yeah, because you kind of go, oh, yeah, you could do this as well. Oh, yeah, you've got a morbid sense of that, and you're a mad person, yeah. And you like this. Oh, no, now you're dead. You're dead. You've ruined your chances, Harold.
Yeah.
You're back to Maud. And yeah. So, yeah, he does go
so, yeah, so with all that happening, the mother's had enough and decides that he has to go and join the army and his uncle.
Yeah, it's that she's tried to, gently to usher him that way.
Yeah.
And she's tried to get the therapist to kind of get stuff out of him, but this time she marches him off.
Yeah. So he's going to go and join the army and he gets taken out for the day by his uncle. Just before that, he rushes to find Maud and say, you know, I've got to go to the army, what are we going to do? And she says, oh, you know, we'll think of something.
They hatch a plan.
So he goes with his uncle and they end up kind of walking around these cliffs.
Yeah, I had to look it up because I was like, where in America does this exist, right? What was like, is this some old fortress or... Yeah.
Yeah.
And where they are, they're in the Sutro Baths because the whole film was shot in San Francisco.
Right.
And this was the first ever like public swimming baths opened in America in the 1890s.
Oh, wow.
And then in 1966, there was a huge fire and it all burnt to the ground, save the brickwork. Which looks like this weird ruins.
Yeah.
And it is ruins, but of something, it's not that old. But
it looks, amazing.
It looks really old. So it's not a military base. It wasn't a military base originally, but it got turned into a military base.
Yeah.
So when they're walking around it, there are loads of kind of veterans who are... in various ailments as a result of coming back from Vietnam, and very darkly at one point one veteran just falls into her like a swampy pond and it's just a really kind of like Chaplin-esque pratfall but in a really dark way because he's a real veteran and it's just not touched upon at all. It's just happening in the background, reminding me a little bit of a Naked Gun moment.
Absolutely.
Kind of just that little gag there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's beautiful ruins.
Bit of a dumb show. So he starts getting his uncle riled up about Vietnam, and he starts obviously going back there and gets really into it. And then Harold gets as into it as him and then just starts getting more into it and then starts scaring his uncle because he's like, oh, what about you slit their throat? And he's like, right, okay, then we need to calm down now.
But it's great because it's a real moment. It's like it is comedy and it's beautifully acted. But as you say, it is a real comment on if you're gonna glorify war, let's glorify all of it. Right? Yeah. Let's glorify the murder and the bloodthirsty nature of what you're doing to human beings. You're turning them into killing machines. And now I'm doing that to your face, you don't like it.
Yeah.
But actually, that's what you're doing. You're just doing it behind a uniform.
I'm like,
that's a genuine, real, like, left-wing position on war and why pacifism exists.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's because of that. But it's just in a really nicely kind of comic package.
Yeah.
And then they turn a corner.
Yes, yeah, they turn a corner and Maud is there. Pretending to be a peace activist, yeah.
The little sign saying peace on
peace,
it.
Yeah. Also, just hilarious that why would there be a singular one reset in the ruins on these cliffs? Brilliant. And then Harold just starts screaming at her.
You commie pig!
And again, it's all this plan that's hatched to basically... try and persuade his uncle that he's actually not stable enough to be in the military.
Too mentally unwell.
Yeah. So it all culminates in Maud just falls down. She sort of pushes her down through this hole
into the sea.
Into the sea, yeah.
And she dies. Which again, I've no idea how they faked.
No,
because this is a 79-year-old woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Who apparently is also a stunt. Again, that magical realist element comes in. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't. Yeah.
It doesn't. You don't for a second go, oh well, that's not realistic. You just you go with it because this whole journey is
because it's that, and then the immediate next cut is them at the picnic on this green on a blanket. So you just go, okay, yep, so she was fine.
That's fine.
We don't need to We don't need to know how that plan happened. We just know it now worked because he's looks happy and content and is obviously not with his uncle anymore. So that's all fine.
I also love, actually, it's worth taking this moment to mention the editing in that sense, because there are quite a few conversations with Harold and Maud where they get going and then it seems like they're continuing, but there's just a cut for no reason. And then and it's them again in a different place having another conversation. And then that looks like it's going somewhere. And then you cut to another and it just, it's like, we don't need to say any more here because you've got the gist of it. Okay, cut. And that makes it a really economic film in terms of its timing.
Oh, absolutely.
Whereas I think actually some people go, oh, this could be a bit self-indulgent. And you go, no, actually that's, they're just not wasting time on any of the rubbish stuff that you don't need, that you know how it ends.
Yeah.
It just treats you like an adult. Go, got that? Great. Let's move to the next bit.
Yeah.
And let's spend time on the really interesting bits.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good marker of the film.
Absolutely. And so then from this point onwards is when the kind of, the sort of the love story really ramps up. And they end up going to this fairground.
Yeah, San Francisco Bay. Lovely, fairground, lights everywhere. And they sit on the coast.
Yeah. And this lovely moment where he gives her this... A sort of pebble.
Is it a pebble? Yeah.
Yeah, with their names engraved on, and
Harold loves Maud.
Harold loves Maud,
and Maud loves Harold.
Yeah, yeah. She says, yeah. So the stone says, and Harold loves Maud, and she looks at it and says, and Maud loves Harold. And says, it's the nicest present I've gotten in a very long time, and then just throws it into the sea.
And he looks heartbreaking.
And she just looks at him and smiles and says, so I'll always know where it is. Just lovely. Then you get this he closes up to her, puts her on her, and you start to hear the just before the chorus that I Think I See the Light, there's this lovely jangly piano bit. And that just kind of comes in, and then you get to I Think I See the Light just as it cuts to a clearly declothed Harold in bed with Maud. So it's obviously the morning after something's happened.
Yeah.
It's never really explicit. And he's just kind of standing, just stays on him for so long. And this absolute look of contentment. I mean, need to talk about Bud Cort's facial expressions in this film, because he's phenomenal. I mean, so is Ruth Gordon, but then she's Ruth Gordon, so of course she is. But Bud Cort, as a young 20-year-old actor who'd had a handful of films under his belt, just phenomenal what he can do with his eyes.
There's a real depth.
And what he can do with the stillness of his face. Like, he doesn't move anything in this in this shot for, like, maybe 15 seconds until he slowly puts up a bubble wand and he's blowing bubbles.
But I think you're right also that this scene isn't about sex or... No. It's about intimacy.
Yeah.
Which is why the sex is neither here nor there. You just have to know that they've been intimate with each other and shared that space and been close.
Yeah.
And that's what we see. So that's what we need to see.
Yeah.
And I think that's really beautiful because it's intimacy and trust and warmth and honesty and all of the things that he hasn't had in his life that she brings.
Yeah.
It's quite moving.
Yeah.
Actually. Really moving.
Yeah, very much so. And again... just perfectly coupled with Stevens and that song, and just makes absolute sense.
Also, what, just on that song, I see the light. You talk about that jangly piano at the beginning. Yeah. I was like, what does this remind me of? And I'm a big Ben Folds fan.
There's
a Ben Folds 5 track, where called "Give Me My Money Back," and it's where he's demanding to this girl who wouldn't date him, "I want my money back for the." And my t-shirt and all the things that you've... It's a really spiteful teenage song. But it's... I swear to goodness, the piano is almost lifted from this Cat Stevens track in the introduction, really jangly. It reminded me of that. But also there's something kind of like there's an energy behind this that isn't in a lot of other Cat Stevens songs. And I thought that's why it's a coming of age for Harold, isn't it? Because he's getting this excitement and this intimacy and this closeness. Yeah. And that's his first kiss probably with anyone. And it's just the same way, just because it happens to be a 79-year-old woman doesn't matter.
No, absolutely.
So and then from that he makes a decision.
He turns up. I mean, again, this house is just insane. Like, he goes into what I'm assuming is his mother's bedroom that seems to have a living room with a television in the bedroom.
It's like the bedroom is a bedsit. It's like a loft apartment.
Comes in and says that he's gonna get married. She's in the middle of a phone call that she doesn't listen to him until he says that, and then the end looks very shocked, and so she's got to go and to whoever she's on the phone to, and actually gives him the attention, because of course this is what she's been wanting. And then she shows a picture and she says you can't be serious, and then decides to send him to all the people again. So he goes back to the psychiatrist,
who's very Freudian, saying that, oh, it's because you secretly want to have sexual intercourse with your mother.
Yeah.
And he's like,
and he says, he says it's not uncommon for people in this society to fantasize, as Freud says. He says, what I don't understand is you want to have sex with your grandmother.
yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And then it goes to the priest, and it's just a horrific.
Now, this is the same priest who had conducted one of the funerals who gets the car nicked, right?
Yeah.
This is an actor called Eric Christmas, who's a British actor and had done quite a few American sitcoms and things throughout the 60s. And I think he's dead now. And a lot of the old actors in this are dead now. But as is Hal Ashby, I think.
I think so.
Dead as well. He's just but incredible.
Still alive, though.
Sorry?
Bud Cort is still alive.
Bud Cort is still alive, although he had a terrible car accident.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what screwed his career, sadly. Yeah, 1979. He turned a corner and hit a abandoned car on the Hollywood Freeway. Years of rehab, facial reconstructive surgery, all this, and being out of the game for that long. Really, really sad. Really, really sad that totally, kind of, and came back to bit parts on TV shows and things like that. Although
cameos and
great performance in Dogma, Kevin Smith's Dogma.
He's
great in that.
After rewatch Dogma, actually.
He's the guy. He's the priest of the church that ends up in a coma in hospital for the the whole film.
Playing another cold character.
Yes.
He goes to the priest, and the priest gives exactly the same amount, like, line-wise, it's probably the same half a page monologue about why you shouldn't do this. But, and I don't know whether this is directed, whether this has come from the actor, because it's kind of meant, it's loosely in the text, isn't it?
Yeah.
That the priest finds talking about sex difficult.
And
is disgusted by this.
Yeah.
But on the way to saying how disgusted he is by it, Eric Christmas plays it as if he's actually terribly aroused by all of it.
It's a line, isn't it? Yeah. He's towing a line where it could come across as either of those things.
And I was in hysterics and cringing and this is gross, but also really funny. Is it? I don't know.
Yeah.
I just thought that is so, it's such a lovely little performance. And I think it's an Oscar-worthy cameo bit, because it says a lot about the church, because he kind of gets real hung up on describing and imagining Harold's naked body the flesh of this 80-year-old woman and just at the very end says disgusting. I'm like, God, you loved that, didn't you? Really worth an honorable mention there for such a nice, and anyway, he Harold obviously doesn't take any notice of him.
No.
Goes back to Maud and they're having one of their evenings and they dance together.
Yeah.
And she says, oh, thank you. This is a wonderful way to go.
So, yeah, so it's her birthday. It's her birthday, yeah. And she's got a blindfold on, and he's decorated her flat with sunflowers absolutely everywhere. And has a cake and all this, and they dance to the Blue Danube, which is what they dance to at the first time he comes to the
right, yeah.
The flat. And as you say, she says, I couldn't have asked for a better farewell.
That's it. That's fine.
And yeah, he looks confused at her, and then we see her in an ambulance going to hospital, and you so realize he's, that
yeah, she's taken a load, taken of, sleeping a load of
sleeping pills. Because she said she was going to at the very beginning of the film.
Of course she said,
I turn 80 next Saturday. And then a separate conversation, she said, 80 is the way you've got to go out. So she made that very clear at the beginning of the film.
And so you realise that she's chosen to spend the last week of her life with him.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
But also, he's fallen in love with her, so now it's cruel.
Yeah.
For him. He has to lose that. And he calls the ambulance. She says, why are you doing all this? But, yeah, you know, yeah. They go. She's in the back of the ambulance. She's like, I don't know why all this fuss.
Why are you
making all this fuss?
Yeah.
And at that moment, he just holds her in the back of the ambulance and just says, please don't die, Maud, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Like, he's just...
Yeah.
Again, Court's acting is just incredible.
Absolutely. And then you get one of the most beautiful lines ever written in anything, where he just looks at her and says, but I love you. And she says, that's wonderful. Go out and love some more, which is just, I mean, one of the most heartbreaking and lovely and beautiful things you could ever hear. A really, really lovely moment. And then that's when trouble comes in, and you then have this, kind of montage intercut of what's happening in the hospital, with Harold driving this car very, very fast.
The hearse.
It's obviously not looking good, and he's losing his rag in the hospital, and has to kind of say goodbye to it. She's very peaceful, is kind of looking at him, upset at him, but also, knowing that it was inevitable, and that was the thing, you know. And
like every medical drama in the last 30 years has used this scene, where you have a music montage and a situation getting worse, and people realizing that things are not going south.
Yeah,
but this is the original and best.
Version
of that.
Absolutely. Trouble is just such a beautiful and heartbreaking song. It works so perfectly with this sequence, and it just takes you into a real place of sadness, darkness, and you think, oh God, he, what's this going to do to him? He was so on the edge already, and a week ago, and he's found this person that's shown him life and love and joy and yellow umbrellas and all that, you know, all the motifs.
Injected colour.
That's it. She's injected colour into his very, black sort of existence at that time. The song cuts and you just hear the engine of the hearse, and it's going faster and faster and faster and faster. And it approaches a cliff and goes off, and then the film freeze frames for a second, but you still hear the whirring engine. Still
revs, it's a really clever choice.
Yeah,
that I'd forgotten about.
Yeah, and then the car smashes.
Yeah,
smashes off this cliff, and if you've never seen the film before, I don't know why you wouldn't think he's done what he's done, because why you might think he might have killed himself is because that whole end montage is leading you to that point, right? It's despair, loss, and insurmountable grief that he's feeling, and
he was close to the edge anyway, like you say. Yeah.
But then, of course, the camera pans up to the top of the cliff, and he's standing there with a banjo, and he just starts playing "If You Want to Sing Out, Sing Out,"
and he just starts
walking off, and he skips off,
and it's the last fake one,
and also the symbolism of it being the hearse, crushing the hearse, getting rid of the death fixation, and going and living,
which is what she taught him how to do.
Yeah.
So her legacy lives on in him.
Yeah.
It's something absolutely, totally beautiful and moving about that ending.
Absolutely.
I was annoyed at myself that I'd remembered that I'd remembered he lived.
Yeah.
Again, sorry if that's a spoiler, but watch the movies first. It is just incredible. But I'd forgotten that he plays the banjo. And it's a lovely call. And I just wrote one, you know, didn't write that many notes really for this film. But I just wrote, it's a perfectly bookended film.
Mm-hmm.
Because it starts with, you know, the music motif and the death and the hanging. And then the film tells you how it's going to end in the first instance of the movie.
Yeah.
And you forget it. Like any good magic trick, you forget everything.
Yeah.
And then at the end, and they go, well, I told you it was going to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not only the director and the writer doing that to us, but it also echoes the fact that Maud did that to Harold in the first 5 minutes that they met.
Yeah.
And it's just a perfectly structured piece of storytelling.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
I think there's something so wonderfully wry about a film that prides itself so much on being subversive, be it having quite cynical comedy, very black humour, to end with an unashamedly hopeful and joyful ending in terms of, yes, he didn't do the thing. And look, he's happy, and he's literally skipping.
Yeah,
and you, and like, how much more of a happy ending do you want than that? And I love that they give you that, because, and that's what's so clever. If you've only seen the film once, not just the end, but the whole film would lead you to go, well, this is probably the kind of film that would just kill off Harold at the end.
Yeah, then, absolutely,
because of the darkness that's strewn throughout the film. So it's so clever to take everyone down there, and then at the very end you go no, because he learned.
The surprising thing about this Hollywood film is that it has a happy ending.
I can't
say that about many Hollywood films.
Exactly.
It's perfectly bookended, and I would also say, you know, as we talked a little bit about the editing and things, it's perfectly paced. This film.
Yeah.
We were talking about a new piece you're working on and how music is a part of that,
mm-hmm.
and how difficult it could be to get the pacing of the use of music and motifs right with any piece of art or with whatever medium. But I would say this is a really good example of a film that absolutely nails
completely.
And we were also talking a little bit about 70s trends of having films that were scored by singular artists.
You were saying about, you know, The Graduate with
that's the one I could think of. I think that was probably the first film I ever saw that had, I'd never seen the film, but I knew all the songs.
I'd
never seen a film that was kind of scored by a singer-songwriter. It was really interesting to me to see that, and it not be part of the storyline.
I can't imagine what this film would have been like with Elton John songs.
I mean, it would have been a very different movie.
Very different film. But interestingly enough, it was Elton John himself that said you should get Cat Stevens to do it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Hold on, Elton.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Lots of integrity around this movie, like you say.
So much. Everyone's just lovely.
Yeah.
Everyone was just lovely and just so helpful to each other all the time. Amazing.
What a great, great movie.
What a great movie, yeah.
So, as the request goes, we will be watching another film next week to compare with this. And this is a film made relatively recently.
Yes, it is. It is. I've been deliberately vague because I've forgotten the name of the film. But I know it's Katie Holmes, and it's Miss something.
Let's find out.
But yes, a request from my lovely sister, who requested this one and requested us to compare it.
Miss Meadows?
To Miss Meadows.
That's the film, yeah.
2014
film.
We called Miss Meadows because she said she thinks it has that same kind of sort of dark-edged character and a sort of, a subversive portrayal of a kind of dark, troubled young character. So, yeah, we're going to be watching Miss Meadows next week and comparing it with Harold and Maud. So there'll be a little bit more Harold and Maud chat to come this time next week.
That's all I have to say, really, until next week.
Absolutely. In the meantime, you know where to find us. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at Macabre Podcaster. You can drop us an email, podcastermacabre@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, fb.me/podcastermacabre. And of course, you can like, share, subscribe, and listen to this podcast. Go back and listen to all our Jonathan Creek podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, Anchor, wherever you get your podcasts from.
In the meantime, I've been Callum Hughes.
I've been David Chopland.
And we will see you next week.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. Because there's a million things to be, you know that there are. And if you want to live high, live high. And if you want to live low, live low. Because there's a million